So we have, and let's see, it's the 31st of July in 2018 in Zagreb. So we were looking at, you know, contributing to Prabhupada's mission, which is what we were planning. And we talked about a vision for the future, yeah? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. And you talked about social development, so those are all very related. And you talked about finding bhakti in the world's traditions without being wishy-washy. That's also related. And then you're asking personal, easiest, so those are social, easiest way to prema. And your question was also personal, which seemed to be similar to that.
Makes the difference, doesn't
it? What's the thing that makes the difference in advancement? And you're seeming to ask about a definition of Krishna consciousness in general with the Zen, yeah? And yours was about external and internal. Those are all personal. And yours again was?
About the mercy of the devotee.
Mercy of the devotee, yeah. Which is sort of a bridge between all that. Okay, let's see if we can put this together. This will be fun.
Challenge.
Yeah, I always like a challenge. Life gets boring. So I'm going to look at the overall societal first. And I think from the overall societal picture, then we can go to the individual questions. Is that all right? And I'm thinking that because we did plan an overall societal thing for today, and because I just finished reading an article of a research done in Mayapur, at ISKCON Temple in Mayapur. And one of the things that really struck me was that the author, who's not a devotee, he was saying that we have very, something like what you were saying, that we have very developed, and he called it robust, ways of explaining individual advancement, but we don't really have anything commensurate for describing social development. That when he asked people about how Mayapur would develop as a city and as an ideal community, we really didn't have the vocabulary and the vision to talk about that. So, I'm going to bring up some things which are not usually talked about. In fact, very, very rarely talked about. And I'm going to bring these things up as not as some sort of final conclusion, but as trying to explore, if that's okay, as an exploration of how we can really develop a Krishna conscious society where the individuals also have these kind of questions, answers. So if we think about Prabhupada's mission, so, and this is also, I'm going to ask all of you, I'm not just going to be talking, if that's all right. If that's what you came for, I'm sorry. Especially, you know, sometimes on a weekday night, it's hot, people are just, I just want to be entertained, but then I have to bring my computer and have to have a screen, speakers. So with Prabhupada's mission, what do you all see as Prabhupada's mission? Anybody want to suggest what they see as Prabhupada's mission? Yeah.
To give everyone the opportunity to progress spiritually, okay, and to be well informed about the methods.
And to be well informed.
Yes.
About the methods how to proceed.
So the opportunity and the information on an individual level.
Yes. He constructed a huge number of persons who are different between themselves, who can explain the same thing from different angles.
Okay. Any other ideas about Prabhupada's mission?
I guess his mission is stated in the seven purposes of ISKCON, which is quite wide.
So give me your feedback on that.
I guess they should be with you, or I should.
You?
Okay.
If you want to.
What do you mean by feedback?
Well, summarize some of them for us. Or...
Yeah, he said that we should work on that, to bring in, checking the imbalance of values in society in large.
Okay, so getting balanced values in society.
And then printing these books in order to accomplish all this, and printing and distributing literatures in order to accomplish.
Okay, which is connected to this opportunity information.
Yes.
So we have the books. What else would you say is Prabhupada's mission?
I think that we have to be a very good example in society. This is my first.
On an individual level, on a group level, an individual level. So people who can set an example. He wanted to create people who are examples. Thank you. Some other thoughts about Prabhupada's mission. Okay, so places of worship. And, you know, he also talked about a place of pilgrimage.
Yeah.
And we see that, you know, of course, in Mayapur, where we're creating this big temple as a place of pilgrimage, and then a number of other places in the world where it's not just a place of worship, but it's, you know, like in New Vrindavan, where they're getting 30,000 tourists a year. And that place. I don't think we'd ever get 30,000 tourists to our little temple in Sagar.
We'll destroy it.
Yeah, we'll destroy it. Okay, so other things about Prabhupada's mission. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, Prabhupada systematically organized knowledge to be spread so that we can be aware of our misconceptions about ourselves, the world around, and relations that we are depending on in our lives, which are not giving results as we expect.
Anything more on the level of society? Yeah.
Examples of simple living, I think, in a farm project.
I think that some Prabhupada said bringing the members of the society closer together.
Yes, yeah. Said closer to Krishna and closer to each other.
Closer to each other, yes.
I always quote that when it's a really... when people in the temple room are all in the back.
Yeah.
And people come in. Closer to each other. You know, in the Nectar of Instruction, Prabhupada says that the purpose of a society is to facilitate the loving exchanges.
Six
loving exchanges. Which are basically three, but they're give and take.
Mm-hmm.
I remember from a Hare Krishna film, he said, we want everybody to be happy.
Oh, okay, happy.
Everyone.
That's everyone.
Everyone.
Yeah, that's the Vedic mantra, the Vedic, you know, benediction. May everybody be happy.
So.
Yes. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
You mentioned before establishing places of pilgrimage, holy places all over the world.
Yeah. Well, Prabhupada mentions one. In the seven purposes of ISKCON, he puts it in the singular, to establish a holy place of pilgrimage. I think we've established several. You know, like I say, Mayapur is definitely a major one. But I think like New Vrindavan in America and New Vrindavan in Europe are two of the major ones that I can think of where people really go there, like to visit a holy place. And I mean, I don't think Prabhupada would be opposed to having more than one, but he specifically said that he wanted to establish one. Yes, we would have that. To correct with the parampara. Yeah. What about Varnashram?
Yeah, I was thinking
about the collective. Nobody likes it.
Nobody likes it. Well, I like it. So. And I plan to talk about it a lot tonight. In fact, I'm working on a book on Varna right now. I was just spent all afternoon with a co-author. And we've already written the book, but we're now going through the second... we're creating the second draft, so we're editing it ourselves, and we're now sent it's in three parts, and we just sent part one to various other readers for their feedback.
So it will come only
on Varna?
It might be a year or so. We're not very fast.
Only on Varna?
Only on Varna. There's one chapter on the relationship between Varna and Ashrama, and the reason that we're focusing on Varna is Prabhupada, first of all, said first Varna and then Ashrama. The other reason is from what I'm observing and studying in 2018, ashram is very controversial and would not be received very nicely by anybody practically. So small, only a very small group of people, even within ISKCON, are open to principles of ashram. And we just had to talk today with one devotee here in Croatia about ashram stuff, and I don't know how receptive that person was. I mean, it's just... As soon as you talk about principles of ashram and practices of ashram, you get resistance from people, generally. Whereas principles of varna, you get almost always enthusiasm. And even if you speak to materialistic people, you get a lot of enthusiasm about varna. So if you talk about the principles of varna, if you start talking about the details, that's another thing. But if you talk about the principles of varna, pretty much everybody's enthusiastic. You talk about the anything about ashram, then people are just... They're ready to beat you up, burn you down. It's not a popular... The society is moving further and further and further away from the principles of ashram.
Why? Why would you say it?
Why? The principles of ashram primarily deal with how you handle sex and money. That's if you want to, you know, what are they dealing with? And how you handle things at different stages of the life cycle. And what's happened now is that people, the mood in modern society, ashram is very biologically based. It's very physiologically based. Varna is much more psychologically based. To some extent, physiologically. Obviously, you can't have a career that you're physiologically totally unsuitable for. You know, if you're a midget, you're not going to be a basketball player. I mean, there's some physiological considerations in varna, but primarily the considerations in varna are psychological. In ashram, they're almost all physiological and biological. And there's a war against biology right now in modern society. The absolute war. There's a declaration of war. That we are not going to be constrained by biology. We are going to conquer biology. It's quite interesting because, you know, there used to be that mood when I was young about the planet, that we're going to conquer the planet and we're going to use, you know, chemicals and machines to force the planet into submission, which didn't work out very well. And so at this point, there's more like, well, maybe we ought to be in harmony with the planet and with the ecosystem, instead of trying to force it to be what we want it to be. So there's a mood now of being in harmony with the whole ecosystem, but there's not a mood of being in harmony with our physiological ecosystem or at an individual level at all. It's a major war. I mean, it's such an extreme thing now that people are saying, you know, you can't tell a person's sex by their physiological features, which is just... I understand that there are people who have great difficulty getting, you know, with having their mentality be in accord with their physiology. I understand that. We're not these bodies. We've had so many bodies, and, you know, we may be stuck somewhere psychologically. I get that. But to say that biology is not at all destiny is just... So how are you going to talk about ashram in that kind of a society, which is almost entirely about biology? Ashram is what do you do when you're this age, what do you do when you have a child's body, what do you do when you have a youthful body, what do you do when you have a middle-aged body, what do you do when you have an old body. And it also deals with what you do if you're male or female. And these sort of understandings are like, you can't even talk about them at all, and not at all, without getting, you know, burned at the stake. Lambasted as some sort of a very strange, you know, prejudiced, cruel person. So how I don't know how you're going to talk about ashram. And ashram also has to do a lot with reproduction. How are you going to talk about that? You know, nobody wants to talk about these things. So, and not only, you know, using sexuality for reproduction when you're fertile, which is also a very peculiar idea in modern society, that people should have children when they're most biologically capable of having children. That's a very peculiar idea today. But also to stop having children when you're no longer biologically most reasonable to have children, and stop engaging in sexual activity at that time. And that's also just, how are you going to talk about this? It seems to me very logical and reasonable that when the body is most adept at reproducing is when one should reproduce, and when the body is not, one should stop. And if you have a male body, you should reproduce like a male, and if you have a female body, you should reproduce like a female. And these things just seem to me very, very biologically intuitive. So I'm thinking that eventually we'll come back, like we have with the ecosystem. You know, we had a period in human society where we were at war with the ecosystem. We were just absolutely denying the natural chemical composition of soil and of natural fertilizers, and the balance between predator and prey, insects, and how to work with the balance of nature. We were completely denying that we were going to wipe out the whole ecosystem and build it again chemically. I mean, when I was a kid, there were advertisements, better living through chemistry. Nobody would advertise that way today. So, but that was the mood, and you know, I used to watch Star Trek on television. It was a weekly show, you know, and you go into outer space and your computer makes food out of chemicals. And that was great. We were all looking forward to having our food made out of chemicals. So we've gone back, and I'm assuming that our present war on individual physiology and individual biology, that at a certain point, human society is going to wake up and go, you know, like I recently read in one book, if your ideology isn't in line with biology, then maybe there's something wrong with your ideology. And so at a certain point, collectively, human society will wake up and say, hey, just like we have to be in harmony with the ecosystem of the planet as a whole, we have to be in harmony with the ecosystem of our own individual bodies. But that time is not now. And so, at all. So talking about ashram right now, which is basically about that very thing, that is what it's about. I don't see us being particularly productive, and in fact I see us being very off-putting. I see as something that will immediately drive people away, and completely unnecessarily, because although working in harmony with nature as Krishna has designed it is very conducive to attaining enlightenment, it's not absolutely necessary. Attaining Krishna prema and attaining enlightenment and spiritual perfection, it is not necessary to work in harmony with nature. It's advised, it would be an awfully good idea. It makes things much easier, but it's not necessary. So to push that when people aren't ready to hear it is probably not a good idea. So that's a long answer as to why not. Usher.
But isn't this working in line with nature? It's the giving up our idea of competing with God?
Sure.
So how is it not necessary for...
Because are we all working in harmony with nature in the Hare Krishna movement? No, we're not. And many people are attaining Krishna Prema and they're not... It's not constraining them. So it may make things a little bit more difficult, in fact. But it's not making it so difficult that they can't achieve perfection. It's not an absolute requirement. Therefore, Rupa Goswami says Varnashram is not one of the angas of bhakti.
Yeah, true.
And, you know, you can have your ashram situation totally messed up and upside down and inside out, and you can still attain Krishna Prema. You can, and we see it. You know, we see it practically. People who first take sannyas and then become grahasthas, or people who've gone through, you know, four cycles of grahastha life, or people who start having children when they're 45. And I mean, we see this practically, and we see that even then they can attain Krishna Prema. It's harder. They've definitely made it more difficult, but it can be done. And you can also attain Krishna Prema if you're driving around in cars and, you know, you don't have to grow all your flowers in your backyard to attain Krishna Prema, but it certainly helps. So, but it's not a requirement. But yeah, it does help, because when we're working against nature, in many ways, we're trying to be the lords of nature, which is trying to usurp Krishna's position. And if we talk about that theoretically, everybody goes, yes. And then you say, okay, that means you should have babies when you're 20 and give up having babies when you're 50. And they go, well, I'm not going to do that. So, does that make sense? So as soon as you take that from the principle to the detail, then...
To the application.
As soon as you say, take it to the application on an ashram level, then most people, even most people who are dedicated members of ISKCON, will not agree with you. So, all right. So I don't want to go there anymore. All right, so if we look at all these together, I'd like to look at... Prabhupada had a mission to re-spiritualize society, yes?
Yes.
Correct? Yeah. So let's look at it from his mission first on a societal level. Because I've come to believe very strongly that although I could answer these questions about individual advancement, and there are things I talk about a lot, separately from the societal things, then we run into the problem that you talked about, where we have this highly advanced philosophy and a very specific and clear pathway, or even series of pathways, to Krishna consciousness. I mean, for both of your questions, you know, I hope, that there is not one answer, that there's as many answers as there are people, that there are general answers that you have to apply individually. So we have that in such detail, you know, that's there, but what we don't have in much detail is on the societal level. So I'd like us to do a little, how long do I have here before you're all going to say that you have to quit for today?
Usually we have it...
Usually you've quit by now.
8:30.
Okay.
30, but we can...
Okay. That's fine. So I'd like us to do a little imagining exercise that, let us say, that Prabhupada's mission was basically completed. I mean, obviously, it's going to be dynamic for thousands of years, but let's say it was completed at least in Croatia. Let's say that Croatia, we're talking about examples, let's say that Croatia was the example, that we can ask the rest of the world, come to Croatia and see a whole society that is following the principles taught by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. So I'd like us to think, what would Croatia look like? And again, let's just stick to this one country, because I think that's a little easier than trying to think of the whole EU or, you know, the whole world. And one of the reasons it's a little easier is that some applications of Krishna consciousness will probably look different in different countries. You know, we're talking about a Krishna conscious government. I think that will end up being somewhat different in different countries, at least in the immediate. Because I don't want to look too far ahead. I don't want to look at 200 years or 500 years. That would involve so much speculation about what the world's going to be like then that it would become almost meaningless. So I'd like to look more at like 5 to 10 years, which would assume that there aren't major, major changes in the world's economic system and the stability between countries. It would be assuming that the world's political and economic systems are basically intact as they are today. Not looking, because in 200 years, who knows what the situation will be, and so things may evolve very differently. So if we were to have Croatia, basically again, within the world that has the same basic economic and political systems, so what would be happening? What would people be doing? And I'd like to look at this. Let's look at this first in terms of bhakti, which relates very much to your question. And then we'll look at it in terms of the varnas. And we could touch on it in terms of the ashram, so I don't want to take too much time with the ashram. So let's look at bhakti. So let's say all of Croatia was in Mahaprabhu's movement. So would there be, what do you think? I'm putting this out there. Again, I'm not coming here as I have the answers. This is exploratory. And I'm not saying we're all going to come up with the answer. But I think it's important if we want to see our place in Prabhupada's mission and we want to develop in this way to have some idea of what that would look like. So what do you think would be going on in terms of religion and spirituality in Croatia? I mean, would ISKCON be the state church like the Roman Catholic Church was in Europe in the Middle Ages, where, you know, you had an official Roman Catholic Church and anyone who wasn't a Roman Catholic was persecuted more or less. You know, many of them ran away to America. That's how America got started. Hey, we want a place where we can be a Protestant. We want a place where we can be an Anabaptist. You know, would it be like that? Would ISKCON be the official state church but allowing other religions to exist? Would there be a number of officially recognized religions, like in Indonesia, they have 6 officially recognized religions, and you're not allowed to be an atheist. You have an identity card. Seriously? I mean, you can be, but not on your identity card. Not if you want to get a job or a house.
Where in?
In Indonesia.
Indonesia.
Yes. Or would we have no official government religion? Do you have an official government religion now?
Yes.
Do you do?
More or less, in practice.
Well, I mean, legally, do you have an official religion?
No.
So legally, it's a secular
yes.
government. Okay. So would the government stay secular? Would the government have an official religion, which we would assume would be ours, because
we are the best.
Oh. And here's this tiny group of people assuming that it's going to be us. But anyway, putting that aside for the moment. Would we continue having basically just simply a group of religions which were all competing and we were one of them? Any thoughts on this? Those are basically our 3 main options. We would be in the official government religion legally, and we really wouldn't tolerate other religions in the country. We'd be the official government legally, but we would allow other religions in the country, and there might be some of us 4 options. There might be some provision as to what religions we would allow and what religions we would not allow. Like right now in America, I don't know what it's like here, but in America, if you say you're a religion, you're a religion.
Mm-hmm.
If you say you're a religion, the government accepts you as a religion. In Indonesia, you have to be one of those 6 religions, and to be one of the accepted religions, you have to have all kinds of requirements. Would we have something like Indonesia, or we have a group of religions that are accepted, and those are the only ones who are accepted? Or would we have something like today, except that ISKCON would be much more prominent in the religious marketplace? So, some thoughts on that.
I think that I read in the first canto, the purpose of Srila Prabhupada, where he says that, if I remember correctly, punishing Kali or something, this part, that he says that it is not a problem if the state, remains secular, but the principles of religion should be encouraged. So the government can be separated from, in the sense of not adhering to any specific religion, not favoring any specific religion, but they should make sure that the principles of religion are followed. And he
talked about mercy, austerity, yes. Right, truthfulness,
yes.
Cleanliness. Okay, so you're saying that there's an option where, although the government is still secular, it's adhering to what we define as the principles of religion.
Yes.
So that would
mean that the Prabhupada's mission is established.
Okay. Okay, so what I'm hearing that would mean is that there could be many different religions, but all the religions would have to adhere to certain principles of religion, which we ISKCON devotees would establish.
Yes.
Okay, that would be something like Indonesia. I mean, there they limit it to six. But that would be something like that. You know, where ISKCON says, okay, this is what's required to be a religion. These are the principles that are required in the country.
Judging by that, I was studying that, when you were speaking, this Prabhupada's words from the came to my mind.
Sometimes Prabhupada says things like there'd be only one mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra, only one scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes he says things like that, although I don't understand Prabhupada meaning that literally, because he did also have the Bhagavatam and the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So I don't think Prabhupada means that we're going to all throw away our Bhagavatams and only read the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, for me, it looks more like a glorification of Gita.
I think. So I don't think
because
that
they say that in Bhagavatam some verses are just glorification and
yes.
Some are, yeah.
So I don't take that as literal, but it does seem, Prabhupada does seem to have some indication of one dominant religion.
But in this section, he really gives principles of organizing society. And he says that it is absolutely necessary to stop killing animals, especially cows.
Okay, so you're saying we would at least have the government would be having the principles of religion. And now, do you think that the four related principles would be followed by everybody in society? No. And Prabhupada, in fact, I was just hearing him say that the other day. So we'd have, I don't think cow killing would be going on, but we'd have probably, my guess is some part of, you know, you can go to some part of the city and there you can buy alcohol and there you can buy cigarettes and like that. But it could be that those sort of things become socially unaccepted, kind of like what's happened with smoking, where smoking went from being pervasive to being socially unaccepted. Any other thoughts about bhakti? In a society where Prabhupada's mission was successful.
There is a hint for me in this history taught by Goswamis. They were working in this Mohammedan government. So theory is that as everything is repeating, that could be something possible to happen, that devotees will be engaged in the government very often because of their qualities, because of their character. And later on I discovered that Mohammedans liked the Goswamis because they were, as Vaishnavas, not tending to learn how to take over the position of the leader.
Preserve their position.
So there were no this tendency inside their heart. So they were eager to put them in a very, very important positions.
Because they could trust that they didn't have personal ambition.
Yes. So therefore they could do other duties and concentrate on them and be completely sure that the state will function properly.
Interesting.
Every citizen of this peaceful. So this is my theory. Well,
this is a very nice idea about government. And so it sounds like that we would have a government where devotees were involved in giving guidance to the government, but in a way without personal ambition. Yes. I'm still wondering about bhakti, if we can spend another maybe 5 minutes on what does it mean that there would be you know, you're talking about opportunity and information, right, to advance in bhakti and having knowledge to defeat misconceptions. We're talking on a you know, an individual level for people to develop bhakti. How would that be manifest in Croatia on a scale for the whole country? What would that look like?
Maybe it can go in the direction that Vineta Madhuraji mentioned, that we find the principles of bhakti in different religions and support this segment of religion, in the sense that that this is underlined in the society. That
even in different sects of
different religions,
in different orders of the people,
of the different religions. That's a very interesting idea. I mean, because what's happened in most religions today, and also can happen in ours as well, we're not exempt from this, is that the religious leaders and practitioners basically become haunted by the witches of bhakti and mukti. And that the bhakti gets lost in going. Mukti means you're wanting God to fulfill your material desires, and mukti means you want God to give you liberation. And so, to restore the element of bhakti. And I mean, one thing that could mean is that on the governmental level, that religions have to be teaching bhakti. You know, that you can have any religion as long as it's teaching bhakti. Which is a little different from, like in Indonesia, you have to have very clearly one God. And I mean, there's very, you know, you have to have a particular prophet, and they're modeling it after Islam. So you have to have a religion that has kind of the Islamic template. So we could say that, okay, you have to have the Gaudiya Vaishnava template, which is you recognize one Supreme Lord in a personal way, and you're aiming for a personal relationship with him without an ulterior motive of material enjoyment or salvation. You're aiming just for pure love. And that, of course, is found in all of the great religions of the world. It's not something that we'd be imposing upon them, but something that they would revive. And so then we would see that there would be many religions, but it seems to me that the ISKCON devotees, or maybe perhaps Gaudiya Vaishnavas even beyond ISKCON, that we're helping people, we're working with religious leaders to revive bhakti in their own tradition. Yeah? And maybe, you know, ISKCON is even acting as advisors in the various religions, because this sort of thing, you were talking about Zen, that you keep cleaning, it's never clean. So this is the principle of purity in religious organizations. You never get a point in the material world where, oh, now our religious organization is pure. Okay, finished. But you're constantly having to purify. It's a constant thing. You know, to constantly make sure, okay, that we're promoting bhakti, we're promoting bhakti, we're promoting bhakti. It's not becoming compromised, not becoming compromised. So it seems like we're saying that we might continue to have a secular government, but devotees would have key positions in the government, not for personal ambition, but for guidance. That within society in general, we would see that the four regulative principles were being followed, although there would be provision in society for people who couldn't follow them, and that the religious observance in the country would all be based on bhakti, although within a variety of traditions. Does that sound about right? Or anyone have any further thoughts that they want to give about bhakti?
Just a short one.
Yeah, we have
to. I noticed something recently that in England there was a time when it was a problem to go in some streets during Harinam. Mm. But then it turned out that at some point the police is helping the devotees and inviting them, please, we'll guide you, we'll go with you in this street and go in this street also and go in that street. And it turned out that this behavior is due to this problematic behaviors of young people in these areas. Mm-hmm. So someone discovered that the Sankirtan movement and chanting the holy name is directly connected with the changing of the behavior of young persons.
Interesting.
So now the police is helping the Harinam in this. So what I expect also that this will, like, the lamp will shine, the intelligence will turn on.
Well, that's a really nice vision. Because it seems like if Quraysh were in Krishna consciousness, that there would be regular Harinam parties, maybe again from different religious groups. It wouldn't necessarily be all our group, but there would be regular Harinam parties throughout the country all of the time. You know, throughout all the cities and so forth, people would be chanting the holy name outdoors and in homes, and it would be like a regular practice that was going on within the country. Again, some people may be singing to Jesus or whatever, but there would be some kind of congregational singing. And of course, that does go on in churches and mosques already. But to have that in the mood of bhakti. Any other thoughts on bhakti within the society?
Maybe practical that we have in every city, with proper buildings. And we have Vedic Academy, which the government approve, and the people can go there and get normal diploma.
Okay. So everywhere that there's now a church, we would have some sort of a... So how many temples or centers do you think we would need for the country?
They're already there. When I was with Padayatra in Austria, the priest invited us to stay in the part where he was giving ordinary lessons to the children. And he was giving us the facility of his own bathroom in his house. And he was inviting us to come in the church in the morning. And he was showing the deities to the people coming to the church.
Wow.
And next morning he invited all the people from the village to come to Mangalarati, and they all came there and participated to the ceremony, and they were all happy. So it looks like it is going to happen one day.
So what you're saying is that we may even be using existing churches and other facilities to teach Krishna consciousness alongside those religions. In other words, we might not have to build temples in each of these places ourselves.
Yes, they're already built everywhere. And people are not going there anyway.
All right, well, that's certainly possible. I'm sure we will have to build some. I mean, like you're talking, places of education. Yeah, so we would have to have some sort of places of education for, I would assume, for children and adults, where we would teach people the principles of bhakti. What about just here in Zagreb? How many temples do you think we should have here?
A lot.
Well,
depends. 108, yeah. 1 million people. Well,
depends how many of them are in this particular religion. If we say that Krishna consciousness is very mainstream, so what does it mean in terms of how many people we have?
Would Krishna consciousness become one of the main... I would assume that it would. I would assume that not only are we talking about reviving bhakti and Christianity and Islam and so forth, Buddhism will be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
How to revive bhakti and Buddhism, I haven't even, not quite sure. Yes, he'll head better.
We can have an island for Buddhists.
Australia.
We'll send them all off to us. I'll tell the Aussies that. Suggested that. But as far as I can understand, we are expecting that worship of Krishna is going to become the dominant or one of the dominant religious forces. That's I don't understand it, just that we'll be reviving bhakti in the other traditions. Yeah. But how many temples do you think we'd need if we were
100?
At least 100.
Okay. That's 1 in 10,000 people. 1 temple in 10,000 people.
So at least that many.
Yeah.
And probably one or two of them might be a very large
temple,
like we have, like Bhaktivedanta Manor, where you've got, 1,000 and 10 things going on. and others would be smaller and more, like some of them would be focused, as just happens naturally, some of them would be focused more on kirtan and some more on deity worship and some more on shastra study, like this happens already in ISKCON. Okay.
But already there, all these football fields are already temples. You need only to make a nice roof and everything is done.
I like you. I like how you look at things. It's cool. Yeah. They're already there. Just bring Krishna into them. Put a roof on the stadium.
Yeah.
There you go. All right. Makes it simple. I like that. I like that. Less work to do, right?
The social rules are like that. You don't have to destroy the layer. You just cover it with another layer. This is a social law. Nothing is destroyed in social terms. So this idea of importance of coming to football match will stay there.
Except instead of a football match, we'll be chanting Hare Krishna.
You are laughing just to chant.
Interesting. Well, this brings me to a related question about culture. So, you know, we're not very interested in keeping the materialistic secular culture. But, you know, I sometimes ask people, you know, do we have an aspiration to destroy all local cultures? If we took over the world, would all local cultures be destroyed? I mean, there are certainly people in ISKCON who behave as if they believe that that would be a good thing.
But Purni Chandra Goswami, he used to say that if you just go some 50 or maybe now 100 years back in the local culture, it looks very similar to Vaishnava culture.
Mm.
There are many elements that are very similar. So it is not that the local culture should be destroyed, but the favorable elements should be encouraged.
Okay, so then it's just like reviving bhakti in the religions, then we're talking about looking at the local cultures and finding what elements of that local culture are conducive to bhakti and what are not, and especially separating the traditional local culture from the global secular materialistic culture, which is, you know, mostly spread through the media, but also by governments and by business, not only through the media.
But they own the media. Huh? They own the media. Business.
Yeah,
that's the same.
But if we need some example, there is New Zealand is an example of non-destructing the natives. There were no wars in the history of New Zealand.
Well, but Maori culture, I mean, and you don't really want to keep all of Maori culture. They were cannibals, you know. Just by the way.
They eat themselves in between.
So we can just leave it. As long as they don't eat us. As long as they don't eat the white people, right? They can eat the other brown people. Obviously, modern Maoris are not cannibals. But there's definitely some difficulty. There's some tension and difficulty between, you know, the New Zealand culture, which was an import from Great Britain, primarily higher class people from Great Britain, and the original Maoris. So there's, maybe they didn't have a war, but there's still, it's not all sweet. And you have the situation that you have in most places where you have natives, where the crime rate, intoxication rate, divorce, illegitimacy, blah, 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 is highest among the original native people. That is a problem anywhere in the world where you still have a large indigenous population.
Because they're not living the way they used to live. They're just
I feel that's the primary reason as an educationalist. You know, it's like the elephant in the room in education studies is that when you have indigenous people, that as a group, we're not talking about individuals, but as a group, we don't seem to be able to assimilate them into modern society very successfully. It seems to be a difficulty. I'm not talking about individuals, but talking about...
They had an abrupt cut to culture.
Yes. Obviously, there are individuals from indigenous backgrounds who assimilate just fine into modern industrialized society without a problem. But as on the whole, as a group, from a statistical point of view, it hasn't worked very well. And it doesn't matter what the indigenous group is. It just doesn't make the slightest bit of difference. Anywhere you go in the world where there are indigenous people, you have this problem. So that's... I don't know if I want to talk about indigenous people tonight. I think that's another issue. It should be addressed in a Krishna conscious society. How do you deal with the remaining indigenous people? Where do they fit in? Where's their place in society? Because it's been a very big problem. And the causes of that problem are wide, and I don't at all pretend that I know all the causes of that problem. It's something people have been studying for a long time, and they come up with all different answers. But certainly one of the causes is that we destroyed their traditional way of life, but not all of them want to return to their traditional way of life either. It's not that all the indigenous people are like, yeah, let's go back to living the way our ancestors lived 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. That's not true either. So many times they want to have some sort of dialogue with modern society. But that's not to negate the urgency for those people, but it is a very small subset of the population. So I don't think we have time tonight. That should be something. That definitely should be something. It was something that Maharaj Prithu in the Bhagavatam addressed, was the different groups of people and the indigenous people. So certainly that's a topic for a Krishna-conscious government, or a government on Krishna-conscious ideals, is what is the best way to deal with indigenous people with dignity and respect so that they don't seem to pick up on the worst parts of industrialized society. It's definitely a question. And how to help each individual make this decision how they want to live it. I don't think we could take New Zealand as an example, having been there several times. If you want to talk about the New Zealand with the Maori, they have as much of a problem as Australia with the Aborigines, and Hawaii with the Hawaiians, and they don't have less of a problem.
In the whole our discussion seems to be that encouraging is actually the way, not imposing them to do something or really aggressively changing. I mean, like Sudama Prabhu said, we have hills on which were the temples of Illyri. Then after that, the churches were built on the same hills, and then a Hare Krishna temple now. And in some ways, it was dealt a little bit more, maybe mildly or more aggressively on the other way. But really encouraging the seed of Govindananda Prabhu, said the seed of bhakti, in different religions is really something that would make the transition more natural.
Let's look at that in terms of government. Let's start as with the Varna, with government. Because when talking about how we're going to bring bhakti in the society, we keep coming to government. Yeah. And what you're talking about, there's some push and pull between the idea that we're going to have by law the pillars of religion and the principles of religion, and this idea of just encouraging. Those aren't entirely compatible. So let's look at if we were going... Because also Prabhupada said that only government can institute varnashram. The brahmanas, the vaishyas, and the shudras cannot do it. So what would the government look like? We have some idea it may continue to be a secular government. We have some idea that there are devotees in key positions, that the principles of religion, would these be enacted by law? Would we have laws to deal with animal slaughter and intoxicants? And then the biggest one is going to be illicit sex, how would we deal especially with things like birth control and abortion, which is the engine that's fueling what's happened in the world today? So this is, to what extent would we be enacting laws which would create this society that was conducive to bhakti? Any thoughts on that?
When I spoke with Gauri Prabhu from England, he told me one thing, because he is quite engaged in governmental affairs and on different levels, maybe not on the top level, but in contact with the top level also. He said one sentence that struck me very much. He said, if you are not at the table, you will be on the menu. That means if you don't, you become a part of constituting the government and laws and everything, then probably government will be completely secular, and then they will have you on the menu. You will not be...
your needs will not be taken care of.
Yeah. You will not be, your needs will not be taken care of. So I think that this, what Sudama Prabhu said, that prominent devotees who are ready to be part of the government, then they are part of the government and they can change the atmosphere, and then they can change also the laws and the principles that would be like with smoking and other things. If you would say smoking in Croatia 20 years ago, that there will be no smoking in a public place, you would just smile, no way. But when government said, it was done like this.
But how did it happen? That goes back to what you're saying. It happened basically first through a change in the mood about smoking. It happened first with information that people get sick from other people smoking. It changed from smoking is your business, it makes you sick, to wait, smoking is everyone else's business because it makes everybody else sick. And as soon as it became something that harmed others, then things started to switch. It's like, wait a minute, you know, this, we don't have to tolerate this in public places. So there was a change in people's information and attitude, which is already happening with vegetarianism. And from there, we pass laws. So we could see that kind of trajectory, that creating an information campaign and creating a mood, which then eventually has the idea of the passage of laws.
That's what the books are supposed to do. But the problem is that we don't read them.
Yes, and people don't read them. Then also,
media.
Of course.
Well, then we're looking at yes. So how... I mean, it's one reason I've written this book. This is a story.
It's more likely that it will be read.
That's my thought. Although it probably would be more likely if it was a movie or a video rather than a book. Especially if it was only
a
3-minute video.
Up to four.
Up to four.
No,
yes.
1 minute to do Instagram.
1 minute, oh my God.
Professional.
1 minute video. So, but that was my idea with writing a story, where philosophy is interwoven into the story, because it's stories that have really changed the values. You know, we were talking about balanced values in society, and we talked about loving exchange and people being happy. So this is generally done much more through stories than through any kind of information or even philosophy. Of course, even our books are primarily structured around stories.
Maybe some plays also.
Yes.
Prabhupada wanted that, like conquering by culture.
Okay, so do you want to move down to the Shudras from the government, or do we have anything more? Because you're now going into
yes,
the Shudras.
Yes, sure.
Do we have anything more to say about government?
It's generally about the money flow.
Well, now you want to talk about the Vaishyas.
I know, but in terms of this is how it's governed today. I mean, everybody are after money, so if you are encouraging certain projects that are in your interest...
So part of that is government, because government collects and redistributes money. Government doesn't create money, but it collects and redistributes it. So one of the functions of the government with that, it would be paying for things that would be enhancing bhakti, and be paying for things that would be enhancing following religious principles, and it wouldn't be funding other things.
Yeah. Like in Croatia, we have that from the budget, there is a certain great amount of money that supports Catholic Church in Croatia.
Okay.
And there's some other churches are also, some other religions are also supported, but the main thing is, and really huge amount of money goes immediately. This is.
So then you don't really have a secular government like we have in America.
It's secular, but in a practice, it's not secular.
It's not.
There's a contract.
Yeah, there's a contract with the government and the church. Yes. And they immediately get every year a huge amount of money.
From the income.
So maybe in the future.
Well, we could also just have that the government supports any religious system that is teaching bhakti.
But you know what bhakti is then.
Well, but that's, we'll get, then now you're going to the brahmanas. Do we have anything else to talk about in government before we move on to the other segment of society?
I was just thinking about this varnashrama, because what you said before about the people will not be able to follow maybe like this minority, this aborigines or whatever. I think that the idea is that varnashrama is in the cities and villages, and those who cannot follow, they have their place, the forest. Now you have pulindas and abiras and whatever.
Are you talking about indigenous people? Well, yeah, you have that. You have people who...
So they have their place in the whole Vedic...
You have that, but I don't... I would really hesitate to say that 5 to 10 years from now, anybody in Croatia who can't strictly follow the regular principles are going to live in the forest like, you know, like the indigenous people did 1,000 years ago. I just somehow don't think that would fly.
Maybe not like that, but some version of that.
Why don't, instead of 10 years...
Under gun threat, and you come on the...
Yeah, I don't know about 10 years.
Okay.
Maybe 100 years. Okay. And I'm hesitant to talk about 100 years, but, you know, that may happen eventually, but I don't see that as 10 years, nor do I see that that would be very attractive. So if we, you know, I don't even know if it's desirable at all, but I don't think that that's very attractive. If we were to go out and say anybody who can't follow these four principles has to live in the forest... You know, like the indigenous people did 1,000 years ago. I just don't see that people would go, yeah, let's do that, any more than if I said people should get married when they're 20 and have their babies when they're 20. And you know, people go like, what? Get out of here. So you know, I just don't think that would
fly.
That would fly at all.
Fly.
I don't see it flying. I don't see that within a 10-year period. Or that being attractive, you know, more like what Prabhupada said when he grew up, that if Muslims wanted to eat meat, they had to go to a certain area of the city, and it, you know, it's like now, you want to smoke your cigarette, you have to, there's some places you can go, and people look at you as, you know, they walk past, like, oh my God, that guy's still smoking. So, I see it more like that, there'd be some places you could go, and perhaps to eat meat also, you can only eat meat from animals that died naturally, and you couldn't eat cows, so there might be some restrictions on that. You know, no official slaughterhouses and that kind of thing.
And maybe we can rethink also that there is no democracy, but something that is going towards the national system.
So something going towards a monarchy.
Yeah.
Now, I doubt if in 10 years you're going to have a monarchy. Because to have a monarchy, you have to have people who are trained from childhood in how to be proper rulers. And, you know, in the time of Vedic monarchy, not only was it childhood, but it was conception, that people knew mantras and they knew all kinds. I mean, they could, from the sacrificial fire, get some sort of food that the wife ate, and then she had a kshatriya kid. So good luck with that. You know, I don't see that is... Maybe someday, but again, I don't see that unless the Brahmins could revive their powers in the Kali Yuga.
I'm thinking more in a sense that this democracy, at least in Croatia, it's who is in the government, they're trying to do something, and all the rest are trying to say how
to oppose
this is
them.
Bad, they're opposed. So you have almost half people opposing the idea, whatever idea is. So for me, it's a waste of energy and resources. Maybe if we could shift even in this...
Do you have a constitution?
Yes.
You do have a constitution.
On paper.
Yeah.
It's not valid.
Not really.
Okay. I'm used to in America where the constitution is really pretty much
valid. We are famous for building a government and producing laws and having sideway government acting.
That explains a lot about ISKCON Croatia.
Yeah, I just wanted to say the same thing.
A lot. It explains a lot.
You have to a club doing proper like advertising, what is this club for? And you have a group of people doing things.
Well, that in general is the material world, because Maya means that which is not. So Maya means that the official presentation and the actual reality, that there's pretty much always a discrepancy. That's what Maya means. It means what you appear to be and what you say you are and what you are, that there's a gap. And the more Maya people are in, the bigger the gap. So that's kind of the definition of Maya. But so, all right, so we look at maybe, and I want to go on to the other areas, but we're looking at also maybe some restructuring of the government to have it be a more cooperative form of government with more authority to enact its laws. And so you don't really have like the shadow government running things. Okay, let's go to the intellectuals. Let's go to the field of let's go out of the field of government. Let's go to the field of ideas. What would we see in science?
In science, they are concerned very much about the person who is looking at the experiment, like the consciousness.
Okay, so we would really go to, we'd start moving to the consciousness and the qualification of the scientist in terms of consciousness and character and not just in terms of academic degrees and scientific knowledge. I really like that. I really, really like that.
This is the shift.
That would be one of the main shifts in science. But we also say that science would exist to find God and glorify God rather than to deny Him. And then I would also say, going back to what I talked about with Ashram, that science would be aimed at learning us how to live in harmony with our individual biology and with the general ecosystem rather than at war with it. So, you know, that right now science aims very much in the direction of being at war with nature. How to conquer nature and how to subvert nature rather than how to work with it.
In genetics and everything.
Oh, we could be here for, you know, a week or two, listing all the ways in which science is aiming at trying to manipulate nature, both on an individual physiological level and on a general ecosystem level, to try to make it into something that we think would be better.
But we are lucky because we have this example of Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, the biggest scientist. So he was trying to manipulate matter.
Yes.
Thoroughly.
Yes, he was.
Right.
He was trying to make
top
the, all.
To bottom.
Yes, all the plants were supposed to bear all year.
And his 5 years old child, what he's telling him, you are not satisfied.
Yes.
You are not peaceful, you are fearful.
Yes, yes.
That is the final lesson to learn.
Yes. In fact, yes, that particular description in the Bhagavatam is only a few verses, two or three verses, that described how Hiranyakashipu was at war with nature.
Science in modern world is developed more, very much around the thought of making life easier. Making life easier in terms of more comfort, more enjoyment. So if the future scientist would actually point out to Krishna consciousness, to the way of living a happy life, then the scientists would be actually brahmanas or priests.
Oh, I like this also. So we basically redefine what it means to have a happy life. Well, so science would still be aiming towards helping people live happily, but we would redefine what that meant. Instead of warring with nature and trying to control nature in a demoniac way, it would more be how can we learn to live comfortably within the parameters of nature. What about in the universities? What would we see in the colleges and the universities?
Slaughterhouses for intelligence.
Within a Krishna conscious society?
No.
That would be pretty unfortunate. What would we see in 10 years in Croatia in a Krishna conscious society?
I have a Vedic academy, she said.
Yes. And what would that mean? Give me some idea of what that means.
teaching that there is difference between matter and spirit.
Matter and spirit. So Prabhupada said that universities should have a department. So like the Maharishi University in America, they have degrees in consciousness. And I'm pretty sure Rasaraj in Mumbai also, who works with universities, they give degree, you know, you can get a PhD in consciousness studies. So Prabhupada said there should be a department of the university for consciousness studies. Any other thoughts about universities?
So it has to be changed in that way. In private life, they
have to prove that... that they're actually practicing bhakti.
Yes.
You know, in most universities, if you want to teach chemistry and you are an acting chemist, that's a good thing. But if you want to teach religion and you're an acting religious person, that's a bad thing. Pretty much all the world universities. Any other thoughts about universities?
Well, the society is based upon this running after fame. So you are going to have a diploma to be prominent in the society, so that it tends to pratishta to be somewhat noticed. So if you are able to understand that the most famous people are in the Bhagavatam, and they are spoken about endlessly in the spirit world and here, so you will be guided to come closer to become one of them.
That's a very interesting, you've come up with such interesting things tonight. It's just, I really like that, that people are going to fame, so shift it to become, you know, famous in that way. That's what Mahaprabhu told Ramananda Roy, the most famous people of the devotees. Any other thoughts about universities?
It's very, very nice.
Yes.
Six opulences are what people...
Well, we talk about this a lot in our Varna book. Yeah. We have one whole chapter about the six opulences in terms of finding your Varna, in finding what field of work you should be in. Is a lot of that is what kind of wealth do you like to enjoy?
So if the devotees are in power to distribute the opulences to the right qualified people, then you are shifting the system value of the society.
Yes. Well, if you talk about the principles of Varna, you're also talking about how to understand that we all enjoy different kinds of prosperity. Not everybody is interested just in money as prosperity, and money is not the only kind of prosperity. Fame is a kind of prosperity. Yasha means righteous fame. It means the fame that comes from Dharma. Yasha is actually a child of Kirti and Dharma. Kirti means to, like Kirtan, to glorify, and Dharma means right action. So to glorify right action. And it's that kind of fame. Whereas just Kirti may be just people are talking about you. So, you know, we analyze each of the opulences and how that... We each like to enjoy different opulences. And the opulences we enjoy are very indicative of what kind of work we should do. But also, the principles of Varna is whatever opulences we enjoy, we protect those. We make sure they're used in the Lord's service. We make sure that they're not in some sort of perverted form. And we distribute them, because we're supposed to distribute charity. We're supposed to distribute in charity whatever kind of wealth we enjoy, which may not be money. Just like Prabhupada told Jamuna, if you don't teach cooking, you'll become envious. So why? Because you want to know more than other people. You don't want them to share in your opulence. So, but that's...
So Dharma is also part of the college?
Yes, the Dharma would be part. That we
because
would teach people their...
Knowledge.
We would teach people their Dharma according to their Varna, and at a certain point... Maybe not in 10 years, but at a certain point according to their ashram. What is, because the idea of Varna, ashram, dharma, is that you have different dharmas according to your Varna and your ashrama. And what is very much wanted in one Varna is very much unwanted in another Varna. You know, just like devotees who are naturally high risk takers, you say go preach in China, but you don't tell them to do the accounting. You understand? people who are, you know, really cautious and they like to do the same thing every day, make them pujaris, but don't send them to go preach in Saudi Arabia. You know, so that the very qualities that make you qualified for one thing make you disqualified for something else. It's always like that. And that's when we talk about dharma. So yeah, the universities would be teaching people their individual dharma, the individual principles of dharma, which they follow according to their type.
And the character will be taken into consideration.
Of the students?
Yes.
Yes.
Knowledge would not be given without taking into consideration.
Okay, so we look at character and not just... This is really heavy. We look at character and not just not just other qualifications. Right? And then what about the way the students are living in the universities?
They must live separately from the families.
That's already...
That's already there in most universities.
That's mostly for the people who don't live with...
I mean, I suggest most devotee kids live with their family if they go to university.
You suggest?
When devotees send their children to university, I suggest those children live at home with their devotee family and not live away from their family in the university.
Because of partying and this and that.
Yeah, so what would we do about that in the universities?
Robert said they can... study.
If they're married.
Yes, if they're married.
Said we have no objection to co-education if they're married.
Yeah.
So that then we're of course looking at ashram considerations and saying to people that of course nowadays people think they shouldn't get married till after they have their degree. Whereas Prabhupada is saying they should get married before they go to get their degree. Which is interesting.
If there's
co-education.
Yes.
So there would be we would be returning to some sort of regulation there. All right, let's go on now to what you talked about before about simple living. Let's go on to the field of resources, or the field of productivity. So this is the field where people are generating the wealth for society. So you talked about that in a Krishna conscious society there'd be more people living in a rural way. There'd be a more agrarian society, but that's not the only aspect of the field of resources. Just like I was speaking to a devotee in Germany who said, yeah, in London, there's this Indian man who owns all these mines, and he's a multi-billionaire, and we should tell him to take his money and use it to make farms to protect cows. And I said, well, okay, but what's he supposed to do with his mines? How is he supposed to run his mines in a way that helps him in Krishna consciousness? All you're thinking about is his money. You're not thinking about the work. And I said, in a Krishna conscious society, will we have metal?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yes, I think we will have metal. On the altar, we have metal, yes?
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to stop having metal.
Even the deities are sometimes...
The deities are made of metal. But the artic paraphernalia is generally metal. Or, you know, we could have pots out of clay. So we can have clay
even
and
our
wooden...
temples.
Huh?
Even our temples...
A lot of our temples are constructed with metal.
Even the deities.
That's what she was saying. Even the deities are made of metal. We have instruments made out of metal.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't have... In other words, not everybody would be engaged in agriculture. Some people would be engaged in mining. Some people would be engaged in banking. Some people would be engaged in trade. And then, of course, it's connected with agriculture, but you have cloth production. Like one thing that I've... Every time I go to New Vrajam, I ask Shiva Ramaraj, what about fiber? So, you know, there's of course that's connected with agriculture, but you have a lot of production industries. So, some thoughts about in a Krishna conscious society what would happen in the field of resources.
I think that the Vaishya should be taught on what they can make profit and on what they can't. For example, they are not supposed to make profit on medicine, on giving.
Are you sure?
Yeah, definitely.
You're not supposed to make profit? I know Prabhupada says that the doctors aren't supposed to charge a set fee, but they're supposed to be given a donation.
Yeah, of course, but not like this, that you sell one thing which is worth a few paisa, you sell it for...
Well, that's not talking about profit. That's talking about greatly inflated profit. First of all, the physicians of Brahman is not vicious.
But this business of healing people is run by the Vaishnavas, and physicians are only employed.
Okay, well, if we're going to look at If we're going to look at the health system, the physicians are supposed to be in the field of ideas. They're supposed to be the brahmanas. And basically, the government is supposed to be taking care of the health of the people. As far as I understand, it's not supposed to be run by the people in the field of resources at all.
Yeah, like that.
Yes. So it.
And also education.
Yes. But let's look just at the field of resources. You're right. Medicine should be taken out of the field of resources and put
and
in the field of...
education as well.
And education should be put in the field of government and the field of ideas.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's... Okay, what else are we going to say about the field of resources?
We should go towards the renewable resources.
Very nice.
Like sun and...
So the basic principle in the field of resources should be sustainability and regeneratability. Can it be sustainable? Can it be regenerative? And these should be the main questions in the field of resources. Yes?
But wouldn't in Krishna consciousness society Krishna provide all? So there would be no need for government because Krishna...
It's interesting that you say that because in the earth has seasons, cosmic seasons, not just ordinary seasons, but cosmic seasons. So there's what we call a Satya Yuga, a Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, and Kali Yuga. In the cosmic springtime, in the beginning of that age, there is no need for government. There is no government. There are no organized cities and villages. There is also no agriculture. There's no need for it. So the earth produces all the food without any kind of agriculture. So if society is perfectly and completely Krishna conscious, then yes. Can we have it like that? Is that conceivable that in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement we're going to, in every respect, recreate the beginning of Satya Yuga? Maybe. But if that's going to happen, it's not going to be in 10 years. So as predicted, we have a 10,000-year golden age. And it may be that in that age... that there will become a period of time where the earth is also again like Satya Yuga. It will not last. It's like in the winter, you may have some very warm days where you can go out in a t-shirt. So this cosmic winter of Kali Yuga lasts for 432,000 years. About 5,000 of those years have already progressed. So we're told that in this particular Kali Yuga, we will have a 10,000-year golden age, which has already started. We're already about 500 years into it. So, yeah, there could be 2,000 or 3,000 years from now that the earth becomes like Satya Yuga and that lasts for maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years because the golden age is going to go gradually up and then gradually down. But that's not going to happen in 10 years. The chances of that happening in 10 years are practically nil. But yeah, in the Satya Yuga, there is no varna. We're talking about the varnas, different classes of occupation. It doesn't exist. And people just meditate also. People are engaged in meditation, and like I said, they don't farm, they don't have governments.
They don't eat much.
They don't need to eat much. There's not much need for medicine. Yeah, everything you need is just there. There's not much need for medicine. There's not much need for complicated education, probably. There's very small schools, and parents just teach their own children, or because there's hardly even villages and towns in the beginning of Satya Yuga. People just live wherever they want to live. But even in Satya Yuga, even within Satya Yuga, the varnas start manifesting. So we have like Dhruva was in Satya Yuga and he was already exception. He was already government. So that, even within the cosmic spring, it's only a brief period of time where those things aren't manifest. As things start to become more and more materialistic, we start to need government, and we start to need agriculture, and we start to need intellectuals, and we start to need craftspeople. We start to need those sort of divisions. And by the time you get to the second age of the earth, you definitely have humanity divided into cities and towns and villages and much more organized government and much more organized agriculture. So that's coming into full swing in the second age of the earth. And by the third age, you really have government is very prominent. You know, the fairy tales and stuff we have of the kings, and that's all from the third age of the earth, when they become extremely dominant. You know, at this age, we have the field of resources and the field of artistry is very dominant. So, yeah, you're right. But that requires a very high level of qualified human beings. which we're not likely to have now. One of the purposes of the cosmic winter is to allow souls who are not really qualified to be human beings to take birth as them anyway. Because all souls have got to have a chance to be a human being, otherwise you can't become enlightened. You can't become enlightened really as a duck very well, or as a mosquito, or as an oak tree. It's pretty hard. It's possible, but it's extremely difficult. You have to have a human body. So what do you do with the souls who aren't really qualified to be human beings? When do they get a chance? What are you going to do? So there has to be a time when the souls who really aren't qualified to be human beings still get a human body, and that's this time. So those of us who are humans in Kali Yuga, most of us are here as a mercy case, and therefore to expect that we're going to be able to live like in the cosmic spring where you have the most qualified people who are there as human beings is not really probably possible. But I like that you asked that question. Any more ideas about the field of resources? What's sustainable? What's regenerative? Taking care of the resources, yeah?
Yeah. And also they should not be allowed to produce unnecessary necessities as Prabhupada.
Unnecessary necessities, that's interesting.
That's Prabhupada's
term. Prabhupada term, unnecessary necessities. In our book we call them manufactured needs.
Manufactured
needs. So they should produce the things that are actually needed by human beings. And
That last.
Well, then you're going to the field of artistry. Now you're moving out of the field of resources into the field of artistry. But that they're supposed to produce the real necessities of life in a way that's sustainable, in a way that can be regenerative, in a way that is honoring the sources of wealth, which are the land, the sky, the water, the animals, and not divorcing. Right now, economic theory is almost all divorced from natural resources. In the same way that the life cycle of human beings is, we try to divorce it from biology. You know, we say, why don't you get married when you're 35? So we're just in the same way that we're divorcing as much as we can our natural life cycle from biology. So the theories of economics have been divorced from land and water, and which is ridiculous because all economics is based on natural resources. So to have economic theories that are, again, based on natural resources. All right, let's go to the, as we are, our time is short, let's go to the field of artistry. So you talked about making things that last. And what else in the field of artistry? We'd probably start getting rid of the factories and start going back to the crafts. Now, of course, we like factories because when my little microphone breaks, I can just go get an identical microphone and plug it back in. So factories provide standardization of parts, but they destroy the soul of the artisans. They destroy the soul of craft. The natural pleasure of the artisans is from creating things and creating things of beauty and function in society.
But nowadays, even this standardization is not so much of abuse because they are changing models so quickly, and the old one, you cannot find a part.
Well, that's also true, and you have a different plug in every country.
Yeah.
When I travel with my granddaughter, she kept saying, Grandma, why is there a different kind of plug in every country? So, yeah, that is definitely a problem. But still, on the whole, we have some benefit, like you're saying, trying to make life easier. But in trying to make life easier in terms of standardization through factories and cheaper, you know, they're available in large quantities at a cheap price and they're standardized, but we're harming basically the field of artistry has been almost destroyed as far as the happiness of the artisans in society. You know, if you want to do crafts, it's almost like a hobby.
Yes. They've been replaced by robots.
Yes, instead of an occupation. So to really restore the dignity of the artisans.
Well, this is a matter of respect.
Yes.
Abilities in
yes.
Someone. So if there is no respect for someone and his craft, then we tend to minimize everything and to put everything on a standard level so that everyone can be peaceful. So that means the lust, like envy, is prominent.
Yes. So let's say we also have the artisans would be, again, doing things in a way that were beautiful and functional. That's their main question. Is it beautiful? Is it foundational? Is it supportive of the society? they wouldn't be just like there. Here we get to not making the manufactured needs. Everything that is done in the field of artistry should be adding to the beauty and function of society, and also to be all the everything in the field of artistry to be aimed at glorifying the Lord. You know, here we're talking about like the fine arts. All the fine arts should be in glorification of the Lord, and even a lot of the practical arts should be done in a way that brings people closer. It should be that even... Yeah? What?
Gichi Gichi
Manitou. I'm sorry, what?
Gichi Gichi.
Gichi Gichi, what's that?
Gichi Gichi Manitou.
Gichi Gichi
Manitou.
Oh, okay. So even, you know, what we use, our fabrics, our furniture, should be stuff that's helping us to remember Krishna and bringing us in harmony with society. All right, I want us to do something before we stop here. I'd like to suggest that if we aim towards this vision of society, and we could talk about this for at least another week or two, we've touched the surface, we will automatically solve your problem. Because we'll have a whole Krishna-conscious society, and we won't be working just on the platform of everybody's trying to get their 16 rounds done, and everybody's trying to read the books, and everybody's just kind of on their own little internal sadhana. But we will be coming together as a society. We'll be coming together in worship, we'll be coming together in Harinam, and we'll be coming together in terms of our occupations, and also probably in terms of where we are in the life cycle. And right now we have this kind of splayed life where most of our life is not in relationship to Krishna, and we have to try to make it in relationship to Krishna in our own individual consciousness. And then we have brief times of coming together as devotees where we mostly focus on, okay, how do I chant better japa, and how do I remember Krishna at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? And we're mostly focused on that kind of thing, rather than having times to really connect. Now let's say that we go back to that our mission is not just to become Krishna conscious ourselves. I personally believe that if we think my mission is to become Krishna conscious myself, to enter into my own state of Zen, shall we say, that it's very difficult to sustain enthusiasm for that over the long haul. And this is exactly what we have seen happen. We have seen, as we've moved away from a, for lack of a better term, missionary spirit, and we've moved away from any kind of a vision for society, we've been focusing more on our own individual and familial advancement and enlightenment and sadhana, that most people cannot sustain good sadhana over many years. And most people start, as I was reading one researcher put it, a non-devotee researcher, that most people end up compromising with Maya here and there. Depending on who they are, how they choose to compromise with Maya is going to be different. But most people are saying, well, I can't really follow this, I can't really follow that, I can't really follow this. And we don't seem to have a growing core. It seems to be pretty much the same number, and people cycle through it. And new people come, and they have good sadhana for a while, and then they can't maintain it, and we have a few old people who've been able to keep it up for decades, but mostly it's
revolving door.
It's a revolving door. It's a conveyor belt, and we should be expanding the number of people who are enlivened to have good sadhana. That's not to say that there won't be struggles and difficulties. That would be ridiculous and completely impractical. Of course, everybody is going to have some struggle and some difficulty with something, but the people who are feeling enlivened, you know, should be steadily increasing. And I see that enlivenment comes to a large extent from having a missionary spirit. And to deal with both of your questions, and to deal with the mercy of, who brought up mercy of devotees? Whose question was that? Yours. The mercy of Srila Prabhupada, particularly, is going to be there in how much we can realize his mission, not only on an individual level, but on a collective level. If we only work on an individual level, that's not enough. It just isn't enough. Lord Chaitanya wants us working on a collective level. Even just the principles of Varna, one of the basic principles of Varna is charity. the Varna Dharma, one of the essential principles. Whatever wealth you are enjoying, you must share. Whether it's the wealth of Yasha, whether it's the wealth of Sri, whether it's the wealth of Aishwarya, whether it's the wealth of Virya, whatever wealth you are, the wealth of Vairagya, even the wealth of Gyan, whatever wealth you're enjoying, you must share. Which is one reason why Varna is only supposed to be done by married people. At least you're supposed to share it with your spouse. You're not supposed to have some single person just working and keeping all the wealth themselves.
Pandava was his only one wife. That's why five Pandavas have only one wife.
They don't. Each of them had more wives. Each of them had at least one more wife.
She has five husbands.
She had five husbands.
Yeah, I talked about that. Yeah.
Okay, that's the other way.
Yeah. But because the principle of sharing, it was there.
That's funny. That was funny. He gets like a maha sweet for that. No, the idea is you're supposed to share your wealth at least with the spouse, at least with children, at least with the animals around your... You know, you're not. It's not supposed to be that, well, I'm single and I'm going to keep all the money for myself. So at least, even if you're a really low-class person, at least you're sharing your wealth with your family members. At least you're doing that much charity. But in bhakti, we're supposed to be giving charity. Again, at least to a family. At least we should be sharing bhakti with our family. Now, if we do that, we will get the mercy of Prabhupada and we will get Lord Chaitanya. And if you want to know what's the most important thing you can do to develop Krishna prema, it's to give bhakti. What's the one thing? It's, again, to find a place in the mission. What is the thing that really develops advancement in bhakti right now as following Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? And this may not necessarily be true to the same extent in the same way always. This may not be a non-contextual truth. Although Prahlad Maharaj talks about this in another age of the earth, that I'm not just concerned about myself, I'm concerned about others. Lord Brahma talks about this in the beginning of creation. I'm not just concerned about myself, I'm concerned about others. But there are certainly persons who can attain Krishna prema as bhajananandis without doing much for others. So I don't think it's a universally non-contextual principle. But at least as followers of Lord Chaitanya and followers of Lord Nityananda and followers of Srila Prabhupada, the main thing that we can do for our bhakti and the main way to achieve Krishna prema and the main way to get the mercy of the devotee is to be merciful ourselves. All right, so having talked about a Krishna conscious society, what I'd like us to do, it is 8:33, but I'd like everyone to take a paper and pencil, or if you want to do it on your phone or tablet, that's also fine, and spend about 10 minutes. I realize that we haven't developed this vision as much as we could have. I realize that we could have spent another week or two or month or three talking about this vision. I'd like you to pretend that you don't have any constraints. You don't have a constraint of energy or money or any other kind of resources. You can have whatever resources you want and you need. Why are we going to do it this way? Because offering something to Srila Prabhupada, even on the subtle level, is still accepted. So if it's really accepted, then he may help us to manifest it on the gross level. And even if we never manifest it on the gross level, the fact that we're offering on the subtle level is important. Also, even though we're going to write something that may be far beyond what we're ever going to be able to accomplish, we can still, by having this ideal that's not dependent on... Removing the dependence on resources frees the mind. Because otherwise we say, oh, I'd like to do this, but I don't have, and I don't have, and I don't have. So forget about all the don't haves. Imagine that you have whatever you need at your disposal. And then what you can do, even if you don't fulfill that fully, you can at least say, what could I do to move toward that? So that's the next question. So the first question is if you had no constraints, what would you like to do in Prabhupada's mission, keeping in mind this vision of society? What would you like to do ultimately? if you could do anything you wanted with no restraints. And after writing that, then write what you could do tomorrow. That would be some step, however small, toward that. And what we want to do is every day at least do something, even if it's just a mental disposition, even if it isn't anything external, even if it's just thinking about it, even if it's talking to somebody for a minute, something to move in that direction. All right, so we're going to take some time right now.